This is Desert Island Torah Parasha Edition, where we stick to our theme of sharing three ideas of Torah in around 30 minutes, but exclusively on the Parasha, so you will have three meaningful Divrei Torah to share at your Shabbos table each week. As we move from Bereshit to Noach, in this episode we are joined by, again by Rob Allen Haber. We hope you enjoy this episode. Thank you so much, Rabbi Haber, for coming on today. It's great to have you on again. So we are kicking off Desert Island Torah Parashat Edition with Parashat Noach, using our structure of sharing just three ideas. We are doing Parashat Noach with three of your favorite ideas from the Parasha. So are you ready to go into your first idea?
Yes, I'm ready to go into my first idea. And I'll tell you now that the second and third ideas are kind of connected. So you could call it three or you could call it two, but we'll stick with the format and call it three. So let's start with Noach himself. The parsha begins Ela Toldot Noach. Noach ish tzadik tamim haya bidorotav. Noach was tamim. Noach was some translated as pure, some translated as innocent. Noach was a righteous and in some way a good person bidorotav in his generation. And the Rashi already tells us, well-known Rashi, what is that word bidorotav? What does that mean to add? Rashi tells us, Yesh merabotenu dorshimoto lishvach. Some interpret this word bidorotav as an extra level of praise for Noach. Kol shekein ilu haya bidor tzadikim haya tzadik yoter. In other words, Noach was a righteous person, even though he lived in the generation which he did. We know that Noach lived in an exceedingly evil generation when the entire world was destroyed because of their evil ways. And even in such a generation, he was a righteous person. And according to this view, what the Torah is telling us is that we can only imagine what a righteous person Noach would have been if had he lived in an ordinary generation or a generation that was righteous. Even though he lived in such an evil generation, he rose to such a level. He would have clearly risen to such a greater level had he been in a different generation. V'yesh dorshin oto lignai. But others read it differently. Others read this not as praise for Noach, but as criticism of Noach. Lefi doro haya tzadik. V'ilu haya bedoro shel Avraham lo haya nechshav klum. In other words, according to this, Noach was ish tzadik tamim. He was a righteous person. Bidoro tav. Only because of the generation in which he lived. In comparison to Noach was just an ordinary fellow. Compared to everyone else who was so evil, he appears to be a righteous person. But had he lived, for example, in the generation of Abraham, he wouldn't have been extraordinary at all. So those are the two views that Rashi brings, and I'd like to just analyze that for a little bit. If we take the second view, that it's legnai, that this is a criticism of Noach, essentially, it means that all Noach was a decent human being, which in other generations would have been not outstanding at all. In his generation, he was noteworthy. Whereas if it's Lishvach, we're saying that he was objectively a good person, objectively noteworthy in any generation. And it's even more noteworthy that he was so good, having lived in the generation that he lived in. So if we look at these two views, what do they both agree on? They both agree that it is absolutely clear that a person cannot avoid being influenced by his or her environment. Either way we look at it, there's an assumption there that Noach is going to be negatively influenced by the society in which he lives. So, according to the view that he was really impressive, we realize that he must have been limited by his generation and he would have been even more impressive had he lived in another generation. And according to the other view, he's only important because he managed on some level to avoid being negatively influenced by his environment. But that's a powerful message. It means that we all have to understand that no matter what we do, it's impossible to avoid being influenced by our environment. Noach was not held accountable for the environment in which he lived. He had no choice. He was born into that world. That's the world in which he lived, and there was nowhere else for him to move. So Noach is not held accountable for this, but assumedly, if one has a choice of putting oneself in a environment which is positive and which, pushes him or her towards doing good things, or alternatively, putting oneself in an environment which is a negative influence, presumably one would be held accountable for that. So that's the first message I think we have to take from Noach. Second of all, I once heard an interesting idea about this, which is that the two views may actually not be arguing with one another. They might actually both be true and simply pointing to two different sides of the same coin. Meaning, perhaps objectively speaking, Noach was only a decent human being. And therefore, it's only because of the generation that he lived in that he's noteworthy at all. And had he lived like that in, for example, Abraham's generation, that would not have been noteworthy. But it's also true that if Noach managed to accomplish what he did in his generation, undoubtedly, had he lived in a different generation, he would have accomplished even more. And therefore, we can, so to speak, Doresh Leshvach and Lignai, and perhaps they're both true. And that leads to just the final aspect that we need to think about when we look at the aspect of Noach, which is that Noach's response to the fact that he was so negatively influenced by his generation, his ultimate response, as he was commanded to do, was essentially to withdraw from his generation, to pull himself into the Teva, to kind of isolate himself as much as possible from them, and ultimately, therefore, he spared from their fate. They're all destroyed, and he alone, basically, with his family, are saved. If we compare him to Avraham, though, Avraham has a different approach. Avraham's generation was not as evil as Noach's, and we'll talk about that maybe in the final Dvar Torah that I'll say tonight. But certainly Avraham's generation was still a generation filled with idolatry and where there were many negative influences. And Avraham, unlike Noach, who sort of withdrew from his world, Avraham went out and tried to change his world. He went out and influenced the world. And one needs to ask whether Noach is to be criticized. There are those who criticize Noach for not having done what Abraham did. And there are others, perhaps, who don't criticize Noach. And perhaps this goes back to that same question of whether we read this Lishvach or Lignai. Noach didn't have the capabilities of doing what Abraham did, and all he was capable of doing was protecting himself, and for that he needs to be praised. Or perhaps Noach should have done what Abraham did, go on the offensive instead of on the defensive. Of course, going out and trying to influence other people also means taking a risk of being influenced yourself. And so whether we praise Noach or criticize Noach, I think that's another level of complexity that we all need to contemplate. So to summarize this first point, I would say that the lesson we take from this one single word of Bidoro Tav is that we need to realize, first of all, that our environment certainly is going to have an impact on us. As human beings, we cannot avoid that. We can, however, choose two things. To the extent possible, we can choose what sort of environment we put ourselves in. And second of all, we can choose how we interact with that environment. Do we withdraw from the negative influences and try to protect ourselves, or do we go out there and try to exert positive influences and try to affect our environment? There's no simple answer to that question, what's the right thing to do? But I think the story of Noah and comparing him to Abraham certainly sheds light on that very important dilemma that we all face.
Absolutely. Super important message. So should we go into your second idea?
Yeah, so as I said, the second and third ideas are a little bit connected, but let's start with the second one. After Noach comes out of the Teva, and after he brings his korban and receives the promises, etc., we have a series of psukim, which are the source for what the rabbis call the mitzvot b'nei Noach. We have here at least two laws that are explicitly mentioned in the Torah itself. We have a reference that to the prohibition of murder, and we have at least a hint as well at the prohibition of what's called Eiver Min HaChai. So let's just understand what are those seven laws. The rabbis list seven laws. The Torah hints at two of them here, hints at or expresses two of them, in these psukim. But the rabbis understand that there was a code of what's called seven laws, Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. And the truth is that the rabbis tell us actually that even though we call them the laws of B'nei Noach, the laws of the children of Noach, these laws actually, at least six of them, were commanded to Adam HaRishon already. What are those six that were commanded to Adam HaRishon? The three cardinal sins, the three cardinal prohibitions of Avodah Zarah, idolatry, Giloy Arayot, incest, adultery, and other forms of sexual immorality, and Shfichut Damim, murder. We have the prohibition of Birkat Hashem, which is a euphemistic way of saying the prohibition against cursing God's name. We have the prohibition of theft, Gezel. And we have the obligation of dinim, the obligation of setting up in every society courts and laws and a system of justice so that there's law and order in every society. And the seventh law, the one that according to many was not commanded to Adam, is the prohibition of eiver min achai, of eating a piece of an animal while the animal is still alive. The reason that law may not have been given to Adam HaRishon is that originally human beings were prohibited from eating animals at all. After the flood, we were given permission to eat animals with this one restriction of Eiver Min HaChai. So we have this body of laws that's given to Bnei Noach. Now that concept is fairly well known, I think, in the observant or Orthodox community. I think people understand that there is such a thing as the what's called the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, but I do not think the significance of this is sufficiently understood in our community. I have a series of videos that I published about 6 months ago that are on my website, which I call Am Levadad. And there I try to develop the idea that the mitzvot B'nai Noach, to a very large extent, are the real purpose of the Torah. What do I mean by that? First of all, meaning what I'm trying to say is it's not simply that the Torah was given to Am Yisrael. Oh, and by the way, there are also a few mitzvot that were given to the rest of the world. That's actually not the message of the Torah. First of all, although we call it Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, if you study the sugyot in the Gemara that discuss this, it becomes clear that we're not really talking about seven laws. We're talking about many, many more than that. At least according to some interpretations, even hundreds of laws. We're talking about seven categories. Seven categories of prohibited, six prohibited and one positive mitzvah, the mitzvah of dinim. And not only that, if we look at these seven categories, we see that they encompass, on a basic level, the main principles of the Torah. What do we have here? We have, first of all, basic ethics, right? We have the prohibition of murder, we have the prohibition of theft, and we have the command to set up law and order and justice in our societies. So that's basic ethics, which is, of course, a major principle in the Torah. We have an obligation of a basic recognition of monotheism and a submission to the will of God. So we have the prohibition of idolatry, of serving false gods, and we have the prohibition of Birkat Hashem, of cursing God. So we have an obligation of human beings to recognize God on some basic level. And we also have even a demand of a certain level of what we can call holiness, not only to live ethically in our reactions and interactions with other people, and not only to avoid the most grievous offenses against the ruler of the universe, but even a simple law of kashrut, that we can't eat just anything we want. There's at least one type of food that's Eiver Min HaChai, which is prohibited to all humans. And the basic rules of sexual morality as well, of not allowing ourselves to degenerate and to just follow our physical instincts like animals do. So essentially, what we have here is on a basic level, fundamental commandments of which the 613 mitzvot that are given to Am Yisrael simply are meant to, so to speak, elaborate on those. And Am Yisrael is obligated to live up to those same principles, but on a much, much, much higher level. So we don't have just one law of kashrut. We have a whole body of literature telling us what we're allowed to eat and what we're not allowed to eat. But that's simply being held to a higher standard on the same concept that all human beings are held to. And the same is true for the other mitzvot as well. And this leads to something even more astonishing, because it turns out, and this also is a statement that many, many observant Jews find shocking, but when you look at it, it's really true. The Torah is not for Am Yisrael. The Torah is not just for us. The Torah is for the entire world. The entire world is obligated to follow the Torah. What do you mean? They're not obligated to become Jewish. That's true. They're not obligated to become Jewish. They're obligated to follow the Torah. The Torah makes demands of the Jewish people. The Torah, even within the Jewish people, makes different demands of different subcategories of Jews. We have mitzvot that apply only to Kohanim. We have mitzvot that apply only to men and not to women, etc. So there are even subdivisions within us. But on the whole, Am Yisrael is given a whole body of laws that we're meant to follow. But the rest of the world is also given laws by the Torah. And in fact, the Rambam tells us in Hilchot Melachim, Perek Chet, Halacha Yud Aleph. The Rambam tells us, here, I'll even read it to you. Kol ha-mekabel sheva mitzvot, v'nizhar la'asotan, ha-reza me'chasidei umot ha'olam, v'yesh lo chelek le'olam haba. The Rambam tells us that any human being, anywhere in the world, who accepts these seven mitzvot, or these seven categories of laws, and commits to follow them, and does his or her best to do them, is among those who are called chasidei umot ha'olam, among those who are called the righteous among the nations, and they have a portion of the world to come. But then the Rambam adds a caveat. V'hu, but this, at least to achieve this on the fullest level, hu sheyekabel otan v'yaaseh otan mipnei shetziva bahen HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'Torah v'odiyanu ha'yidei Moshe ben Rabbeinu shebenei Noach mikedem nitztavu bahen. In order to get the full credit for observing these seven laws, it is not sufficient for a Gentile to say, look, I'm an ethical person. I believe in God, so I don't worship idols and I don't curse God. And I believe that I shouldn't, murder, and I shouldn't steal, and I shouldn't commit adultery. And therefore I live an ethical life. That's good, but that's not fully sufficient for the non-Jew, for the Gentile, to reach the level of chasidei umot ha'olam and to be guaranteed a share in the world to come. For that, there's something else that this person has to do. This member of one of the nations of humanity has to also believe that he or she is following these laws because they're in the Torah, which was given to Moshe Rabbeinu, and which informs the world that these mitzvot were commanded from the beginning of time to the children of Adam and to the children of Noah. In other words, the nations of the world are obligated to actually follow the Torah. The Torah is not for Am Yisrael. The Torah is for the entire world. And the fact that that sounds so shocking to so many of us already goes beyond the scope of this short Dvar Torah and Parshat Noach. You can hear more about that if you watch my videos. But basically, I think what this is leading to is a paradigm shift in how we have to think about the way in which we think about our role as Am Yisrael in the world at large. It's not that the purpose of the Torah is for Am Yisrael to serve God, and the rest of the world has these Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach as kind of like a footnote or a side point. No. The reason the Torah was given, first and foremost, is so all of humanity will serve God through this set of laws that we call Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. And then the Am Yisrael was chosen in order to be the one to lead the rest of the world to do that. But that already gets into my third Dvar Torah. So shall we go straight into that, or do you want to
say
something in between?
Let's go.
All right, so let's slide from that right into the third Dvar Torah, which is about the incident that goes by the name of Migdal Bavel, or the Tower of Babel, at the end of the Parsha. Now, this is one of those things that many of us learned about as children. And when you become an adult, unfortunately, many people never outgrow their childish understandings of things. When you become an adult, if you read the Torah with adult eyes, suddenly new questions often pop up. Let's just read the psukim here that introduce to us this story. So we're told, I'm reading here from the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph in Parshat Bereshit, or the beginning of Shvi, the seventh Aliyah, in Parshat Noach. And it tells us, this is already generations after the Mabul, the world has become repopulated, and we're told, Vayihi kol ha'aretz safa echat udvarim achadim. The whole world spoke one language, but not just that they spoke the same language. I don't know if it was English or French or Chinese or Hebrew or I don't know what, but it's not only referring to language in the sense of the codes that we use to communicate with each other. They also had dvarim achadim. They were united in what they said. Or perhaps, as we say colloquial today, they didn't just speak the same language, but they were speaking the same language, right? They all saw things the same way. We have this depiction here of what's described here as all of humanity settling in this place, the Valley of Shinar. And they decided to settle there, but they had a problem. They had a problem. They wanted to live in this valley, which, by the way, is a very fertile area. which is probably why they wanted to live there. You can grow food there very, very well. But they had a problem there. Because it's a valley with lots of mud, they didn't really have stones there. And they couldn't build houses because in those days you needed houses to build. Yeah, you needed stones to build houses. So what did they do? They put their heads together and they invented new technology. They said, well, if we take the mud and we bake it in an oven or we burn it, then we can make bricks. We can basically make artificial stones. We don't have stones to build houses for, but we can make our own stones. So they worked together as a group. They came up with a new technology in order to figure out how to solve their problem and build houses together. Vayomru, and then they said, Havanim nelanu ir. Now that we know how to build houses, let's build a whole city. Umigdal virosho b'shamayim, and in the middle of the city, there'll be this huge tower. V'nase lanu shem, and let's make a name for ourselves. Everyone will see that tower that the people in, why do we want to build this? Pen nafotz al p'nei kol ha'aretz, lest we scatter. So basically, what are they saying here? You know, this is great. We're all working together. And we have this society where we're all unified. Let's make sure that we always stay unified. Let's make sure that we never become divided. We're going to build this big city with room for us. We're going to build this big tower as a symbol so that we all remember how great our society is, and we will all stay together as one forever. Darcy, how does that all sound to you?
Crazy.
Crazy? To me, it sounds pretty nice. To me, it sounds pretty almost utopian. Hear what we just said. We just heard a description of a society where the entire world is united, where they all work together to make the world a better place for everybody, and where their biggest worry is, we're so united now, we want to make sure we always stay united. Doesn't that sound pretty good?
Yeah, but what about the rest of the world?
Doesn't that sound like what all of human society is like hoping to one day get to? Doesn't that sound utopian?
Yeah.
And yet the Torah tells us that apparently there was something wrong with that. God came down, whatever that means, and saw what they did. Look, they're one nation, they speak the same language, and look what they did. And he goes on to tell us, we say, how God decided he has to stop this, and he somehow created a situation where they started speaking different languages and they weren't able to communicate, and they all went off in different directions, each to become a different nation, speaking its own language with its own culture. And that's how the whole world, came to be the way it is now. And that's the story that Torah tells us here. And the question that one needs to ask is, what in the world does this mean? What was wrong? What did they do wrong? And the Mefarshim deal with this. They all come up with different answers. One answer that Rashi quotes from a number of Midrashim, which is, I think, what a lot of us were taught as children, and it's certainly an approach. It's in Rashi. The people here had a certain type, that there was some form of idolatry that was associated with this. Whether there was, as some say, some kind of a idol that was erected at the top of this, whether this was some sort of platform which was used for the worship of idolatry, which, by the way, there may be some historical connection to. Many connect this narrative in the Torah with something that we know from ancient Babylon. They had these very large towers that were called ziggurats, which were used for idolatry, and some see echoes of that in these early Midrashim that Rashi quotes, or whether they wanted to climb up to the top of the tower so that they could wage war against God. So one approach here is to see some sort of idolatry in this. Rashi also quotes a different approach, which is that people were worried about the Mabul that had happened several generations earlier. And they had these, I guess you would call them today, scientists who came up with this theory that basically every 1,656 years, which is how long it had been since created, the skies kind of collapse periodically, in order to prevent the next catastrophe, we're going to build these big supports to hold up the sky so that it shouldn't collapse. And I think what that approach is trying to say is that instead of understanding that the Mabul had been, first of all, there had been a promise that there wouldn't be another Mabul. So if they knew about that promise, they didn't believe it. That would be one criticism. And second of all, that instead of understanding that the Mabul was a punishment a divine punishment for the sins of humanity. Instead, they viewed it as just sort of a, you know, something that happened, and they tried to come up with a scientific explanation and try to solve it without doing the soul searching that's necessary. So that's maybe a slight variation on the theme of idolatry. But there are other approaches as well. The Ibn Ezra, even before I get to Ibn Ezra, Nechama Leibovitz quotes a midrash from Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer that says something very different here. I'll read the key line. It says that, you know, they had this project to build this great tower, and they had this whole assembly line, Ma'alima Talavinin Mikan, Viardim Mikan. People would carry the bricks up to the top on one side, and they go down the other side, and it was this whole procedure. Im Nafal Adam Vamet, and if in the process of building this tower, a person would fall and die, Lo Ayu Samim Levelav, they wouldn't really pay attention to him. But Im Nafla Levenacha, but if one of the bricks would fall and break, they would cry and say, oh no, this brick broke, and now our work is going to be behind schedule. That midrash is fascinating. So what's fascinating is that this midrash, which was written thousands of years ago, sort of anticipated some of the dangers and some of the ills that we see definitely in totalitarian societies, but not only. Even in modern democracy, sometimes the individual, there's a sense of unity, but the unity is really about the society and not about the individual. What's fascinating about this midrash is that even though it was written so many thousands of years ago, it anticipates some of the ills of modern society, where sometimes there's a unity that's not really unity, but it's a unity that's based around the idea of the state or the society, the culture, and allows that society to kind of trample the individual. This is certainly true in totalitarian societies, communist societies and stuff like that. But not only, you know, when they built the Empire State Building in New York in the early 20th century, at the time it was the tallest building in the world, they built it in slightly more than a year, which is astounding when you think about how long it takes to do any sort of public works project today. But the reason they were able to do that is that they didn't have such significant safety procedures, and a lot of people died to get that building up. Something similar happened when the Panama Canal was dug as well. It was an incredible feat of engineering. A lot of people gave their lives for that canal to be built. And this midrash is kind of anticipating that, you know, sometimes the idea of unity and the good of society can allow the individual to be trampled. So that's another interpretation. The Ibn Ezra has even another interpretation where he says that it wasn't actually a punishment at all. The people didn't do anything wrong, really. It's just not what God wanted. God didn't want all the people to be together. God didn't want one society. God wanted many societies speaking different languages and developing different cultures, and all of them serving him in their way. So he, according to this approach, it wasn't the punishment, but it was simply not what God wanted, and therefore he divided the world up. So first of all, I just think it's fascinating and important to, you know, to look at a story like that we were taught as children, and to look at it again with fresh eyes and say there's probably a lot more here than meets the eye. And each one of those interpretations, I think, has lessons for us in our world today. But what I want to just kind of close with, because we're basically out of time here, I think, is a point that I heard from one of my teachers, Rabbi Menachem Liebtag, decades ago, which has kind of been reverberating in my head every time I read a Parshat Noach. And this kind of, or really anytime, every year as we go through Sefer Bereishit. And this is going to enable me to connect this third Dvar Torah with the second one. A few minutes ago, we spoke about the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. And I made the claim, which again I elaborate on in my Am Levavad series, that the Torah is really not for Am Yisrael, the Torah is really for the entire world. Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach is the universal aspect of the Torah, and that's really the point. And yet we know that most of the mitzvot in the Torah apply only to us. It's also true that the majority of Sefer Bereishit tells the story of Am Yisrael. But that story begins in next week's Parsha, in Parshat Lech Lecha, with the choice of Avraham. And the rest of Sefer Bereishit tells us about Avraham and about Yitzchak, and how Yitzchak was chosen over Yishmael and Avraham's other children, and how Yitzchak had two children, how Yaakov was chosen over Esav, and it talks about Yaakov's 12 children, how eventually they went down to Egypt and laying the foundation for what's going to happen in the rest of the Torah. That starts from chapter 12 of Sefer Bereishit. But Sefer Bereishit doesn't begin with Lech Lecha. Sefer Bereishit begins with Adam HaRishon, Noach, and with the story of Dor HaPlaga, with the generation that built the Tower of, of Bavel. And how everyone understands this story, and how everyone understands what was or wasn't wrong at this point in human history, the Torah is giving us a model here of understanding that all of the children of Adam, all of humanity, which at one point was united, was Dvarim Achadim Safa Echad, somehow became divided into many, many, many nations, living in different places, speaking different languages, and having different cultures. And what is the next thing the Torah tells us after that story ends? We have the 10 generations linking Noach with Abraham. Once we have humanity divided into multiple nations, now we need the choice of one nation. And I don't want to take away whoever's going to be your guest next week when you'll talk about Abraham. But I'll just point out that the next thing the Torah tells us is that Abraham was born. We get only very basic biographical information about Abraham until he reaches the age of 75. And then we're told Abraham's given that great command of Lech Lecha for the purpose of Ve'ezcha L'goy Gadol, for the purpose of becoming that great nation, the nation that we call Am Yisrael, and what I call the Am Levadad, and whose great mission is V'nivruchu V'cha Kol Mishpachot Adama. Abraham is chosen in order to bring blessings to the entire world. So to summarize these last 2 points in one, this is what we have, therefore. We have the foundation of the Torah in the mitzvah of Bnei Noach, and that's the point. We have the fact that humanity, though, that at one point early in human history perhaps was united, ultimately becomes split into these many, many nations. And we have one nation, therefore, which is chosen and given the majority of the mitzvot in the Torah so that they have to live on much higher standards than the rest of the world for the purpose of bringing the messages of God to the rest of the world so that ultimately the rest of the world will follow the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach as they were taught to Moshe and Har Sinai, as the Rambam we quoted said, for the purpose ultimately of reuniting the world, of bringing back the unity that was broken down with whatever was wrong with the society that built Migdal Babel, and ultimately to have a society which unites the people, not around the tower that they built, but around the service of the one true God. And that already takes us to Yemot HaMashiach and the purpose of everything, but the foundation for it all is right here in Parsha Noach.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on today and sharing such incredible Torah for Parsha Noach.
Okay, great. And if you'd like to hear more about these ideas, please check out my video series. Darcy will put the link to it in the show notes on the podcast. Thanks for having me, Darcy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Desert Island Torah. Feel free to share our podcast with family and friends so that we can reach out to Am Yisrael. And if you enjoyed that episode, please feel free to download and subscribe. And if you want to discuss your own Desert Island Torah, get in touch at desertislandtorah@gmail.com. Thank you again for listening.